I want you to try something for me right now. Just take a look at the device you are listening to this on. You know, maybe it is your phone or your laptop, or maybe you are just staring at a car dashboard. It looks completely solid.
Yeah, you can reach out and knock on it.
Exactly. It feels real. But here's the question that has basically kept philosophers awake at night for, well, about 2,500 years. Is that thing actually real? Or is it,
Just your shadow.
right, is it just a temporary snapshot of something else?
I mean, it sounds like the opening line of a sci-fi movie, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, we are all about to discover we're just living in a computer simulation or something.
It really does. But this is not science fiction at all. This is actually the engine that built the entire Western mind. So today, we are going on a deep dive. And I mean a really deep dive into the source code of Western thought.
We really are.
Yeah, we are unpacking a lecture on the history of philosophy by Dr. Arthur Holmes, and we are tackling the big one today, Plato's theory of forms.
And honestly, this is one of those topics where people kind of assume they already know what it means.
Oh, for
You
sure.
know, you picture these guys in togas standing around Athens, pointing at the sky, talking about the perfect chair.
Yeah.
But when you actually read the source material, specifically how Dr. Holmes breaks it down, you realize this is not just ancient history.
No, not at all.
Plato literally built the mental models, what Holmes calls the metaphysical models that we are still using today, and we usually do not even realize we are using them.
That was the absolute biggest takeaway for me. We are walking around running software that was coded in roughly 300 BC. But here's the twist that I just absolutely loved in these lecture notes. We aren't just going to sit here and watch Plato build this massive, towering theory of reality. We are also going to watch him take a sledgehammer to his own work.
That is the most fascinating part of all this.
Yeah.
Because normally, you know, you expect a philosopher to defend their ideas to the bitter end.
Right, defend the turf.
Exactly. But Plato actually sits down and writes a dialogue where he interrogates his own theory, finds the cracks, and just exposes them for everyone to see. It is incredibly intellectually honest.
It is, and we are going to get into those cracks later on. Specifically, there is this thing called the problem of mud,
The med problem, yes.
which is exactly as funny and profound as it sounds. But before we get to the mud, we really need to start with the foundation. Dr. Holmes starts this whole lecture by drawing a massive line in the sand between two specific words, knowledge and opinion.
Right. And we have to be super careful here because the way we use those words today is very different. In our modern context, opinion usually just means, you know, I think pineapple belongs on pizza.
A subjective preference.
Exactly. But Plato is using the word opinion in a much more structural, almost technical kind of way.
So help us recalibrate here. When Plato uses the word opinion, what exactly is he talking about?
Well, he is talking about the fundamental instability of the physical world. Holmes really emphasizes this concept of flux. So think about that phone or that dashboard you were looking at a minute ago. Is that object permanent?
No. I mean, give it a couple of years and the battery dies or it gets slow. Give it 1,000 years and it is just dust. Give it 1,000,000 years and the atoms are totally scattered across the universe.
Exactly. Holmes quotes this famous line from an old hymn, "Change and decay in all around it the other." Plato looks at the entire physical world, the sticks, the stones, the trees, human bodies, and he says, "Look, everything here is constantly changing."
It is in flux.
Right. And if something is changing, it is not stable. And if it's not stable, you cannot have permanent capital K knowledge about it. You can only ever have an opinion based on what it happens to look like right this exact second.
Wow, that is just a wildly high bar for what counts as knowledge. Basically, if I can touch a thing, I can't truly know it.
Precisely. Because the very moment you claim to know it, it has already changed into something else. It is temporal. Plato says these physical things are only tethered briefly, but then they just float away.
So they slip through your fingers?
Yeah. True knowledge, for Plato, has to be about things that are innate, that are unchanging, and absolutely certain.
Which perfectly leads into this really beautiful metaphor that Holmes highlights about education. If we can't get real knowledge from the outside world, because the outside world is basically just rotting matter, where do we get it?
We have to unlock it from the inside.
The pregnant mind. I just love this image from the lecture.
It is the Socratic method in a nutshell. Holmes explains that Plato viewed the human mind as literally being pregnant with knowledge from a previous existence.
Because the soul is eternal.
Right, the soul is eternal, so it has already seen the ultimate truth before we were even born. We have just forgotten it all because we are so constantly distracted by the physical world around us.
So in this view, a teacher isn't just someone filling up an empty bucket with facts. The teacher is more like a midwife.
That is exactly the metaphor.
Yeah.
We do not transmit knowledge to someone like we are downloading a file to a hard drive. We elicit it. We draw it out of them.
Yeah.
The teacher's whole job is to just ask the right questions, to engage in the dialectic, and help you give birth to the ideas that are already sitting there inside you.
It really shifts how you view learning altogether. It is not about memorizing things. It is actually about remembering reality.
Exactly.
But this brings us to the big obstacle. We have this eternal knowledge buried inside us, but we are walking around all day in a world made of sticks and stones and puppy dog's tails.
Puppy dog's tails.
Which is just how Holmes puts it. And it is such a great phrase for just all the random stuff that doesn't last. So to get past the puppy dog's tails and access this eternal knowledge, Plato says we have to look at the forms.
The forms, yes.
Okay, we need to stop right here. Because form is another one of those tricky words. When I hear form, I immediately think of like filling out paperwork at the DMV.
Yeah.
And when I hear the other common translation, the word idea, I just picture a cartoon light bulb popping up over my head. But Holmes is extremely clear in his lecture that neither of those is what Plato actually means.
No, not at all. And that translation issue causes so much confusion. In English, an idea is a psychological state. It is something happening inside your physical brain.
Yeah.
It is subjective.
My idea versus your idea.
Exactly. But the Greek word Plato uses, which is eidos or morphe, refers to an actual object of reality. It exists entirely outside of your mind.
Okay.
That is why Holmes suggests we really should be using words like archetype or ideal instead of idea.
So it is not my idea of a thing. It is literally the perfect blueprint for the thing.
Yes. Think of it as the ultimate standard against which everything else in the universe is measured. Holmes uses the example of humanness.
Okay, let's bring that down.
Well, you and I are humans, but we are what Plato would call particulars. We are specific, individual instances of human.
And we are flawed.
Very flawed. We age, we get sick, our bodies change, we look different from each other. We are basically temporary, imperfect copies. But the only reason we qualify as human in the first place is because we participate in the eternal, perfect form of humanness.
And this is exactly where we get the best vocabulary word of the entire deep dive, horsity.
It sounds so ridiculous when you say it out loud.
It really does. Horsity, the essential quality of being a horse.
Yes.
But I actually get it. Every single horse you see eating grass in a physical field is just a shadow. It is a rough sketch that is trying to live up to the perfect eternal form of horsity.
And while horsity is a funny example, the implications become incredibly huge when you switch to talking about concepts like justice or love or equality.
Right, because if justice is just an opinion, meaning it is just based on the changing physical world, then justice just becomes whatever the guy with the biggest army decides it is.
Exactly. It becomes completely relative. Mine's mates right.
Yeah.
But if there is a form of justice, an objective eternal reality that exists totally outside of human opinion, then we suddenly have an actual standard.
We have a measuring stick.
Right. We can point to a king or a specific law and confidently say, that is unjust, because we are comparing it to the eternal form of justice.
It anchors morality in something real, but I have to be completely honest with you here. When we sit around talking about the perfect horse in the sky or the form of the good, it feels very mystical. It feels a little floaty.
It definitely can feel that way to a modern mind.
But then Holmes dropped the math connection, and suddenly the whole theory just clicked perfectly into place for me.
The math connection is almost always the aha moment for listeners. Because even if you do not think of yourself as a Platonist, you probably are one whenever you do math.
Walk us through this, because the example he gave about a geometric point was just so good.
Okay, let's think back to high school geometry class. How exactly do you define a point?
A point has location, but it has no dimension, no size at all.
Right. Now, I want you to try to physically visualize that. Can you draw a point for me?
Well, I can take a pencil and push it down to make a dot on a piece of paper.
Okay, now imagine looking at that pencil dot under a highly powerful microscope. What do you actually see?
I see a messy mound of graphite. It has width, it has height, it has jagged, irregular edges. It is a three-dimensional physical object.
So it is not a point. It has dimension.
Right. It is just a symbol of a point.
Exactly. That dot on the paper is just a physical shadow. It is an imperfect copy. But the actual concept of the point, the mathematical reality of location without dimension, where does that exist?
It doesn't. Not physically.
You cannot touch it. You cannot weigh it. But is it real?
I mean, yes. Literally all of geometry depends on it being real. We engineer and build actual bridges based on it.
There you go. You are openly admitting that there are ideal entities that are completely real, unchanging, and universal, but they do not exist anywhere in the physical world. That is the theory of forms.
So when we say 2 plus 2 equals 4, we are not talking about taking two physical apples and adding two more physical apples. We are talking about the form of 2 and the form of 4.
Correct. 2 plus 2 equals 4 is an eternal truth. It does not rot like a puppy dog's tail. It does not change depending on who gets elected to run the government.
Right.
Holmes argues that mathematics is the absolute strongest evidence we have that Plato was onto something real. That there is a solid bedrock of knowledge that is totally separate from the mess of opinion and changing matter.
Okay, so we have this fundamental split established. We have the physical world on one side, which is opinion, change, and shadows. And we have the world of forms on the other side, which is knowledge, stability, and math. Now, this is where Holmes zooms out and looks at the big picture. He says, look, this is not some abstract logic game. This theory actually created the metaphysical models that shaped all of Western history.
This part is so key. Holmes traces how this one specific idea evolved into three massive operating systems that humanity has lived under. And if you understand these three models, you basically understand the last 2,000 years of human history.
Let's break them down. Model one is what he calls the Greco-medieval model.
Yes, and this was the dominant worldview for roughly 1,000 years, from about 400 AD to 1400 AD.
Yeah.
It is fundamentally a hierarchical model. Because of Plato, and later his student Aristotle, people viewed the entire universe as a great chain of being.
So a vertical structure.
Exactly. You have the forms, or later, God, sitting at the very top, and mere physical matter down at the very bottom. Everything had its exact place in the hierarchy.
Society was hierarchical. The church was hierarchical. The very cosmos was hierarchical. And Holmes points out something here that genuinely surprised me. The early church fathers actually borrowed Plato's vocabulary to explain the Christian Trinity.
It is brilliant when you look at it. They had to explain this complex theological idea of how God could be one and three at the same time.
Which is tough.
Very tough. So they grabbed the Greek philosophical terms that were already trusted. They used the word essence, representing the universal form, to describe the oneness. And they used subsistence, representing the particulars, to describe the three individual persons.
They were literally using Greek metaphysical hardware to run Christian theological software. I just never connected Platonic horsey to the Nicene Creed before.
It is the exact same underlying logic. But that is model one. It is all about order and hierarchy. Then we hit the 1500s and 1600s, the Renaissance happens, the scientific revolution takes off, and we violently shift into model two, the mechanistic model.
This is the world of Isaac Newton.
Yes, and it is a massive paradigm shift. In model two, we strip away all the forms, we completely strip away the hierarchy and any sense of innate purpose in the universe. And what is left once you remove all that?
Matter in motion. That is it.
Just blind atoms bouncing around in the void. The entire universe just becomes a giant clock. A machine.
Holmes drops a quote from the poet Tennyson here, and it is actually quite haunting. He says, "Who could take a thing so dead
and embrace it for his mortal good?"
Yeah.
Tennyson is directly reacting to the sheer coldness of this mechanistic model. In this view, there is no form of the good guiding the universe. It is just blind, uncaring physics. It is completely inert.
Which naturally pushes us into model three, the organic model. This kicks in around the 19th and 20th century.
Right. You see this start with romanticism in the arts, but it really takes off with modern physics, Einstein's relativity, quantum mechanics. Science itself started to realize that matter isn't actually made of hard little chunks like billiard balls.
It is energy fields.
Energy fields, ecosystems, webs of relation. Everything is deeply interconnected in a way that Model 2 couldn't explain.
So it is organic. It feels alive in a totally different way than the hierarchy did.
It does. But Holmes makes a really sharp observation here that I think applies to every single person listening to us right now.
Oh, I agree.
He says that intellectually, we have clearly moved to Model 3.
Mm.
We talk about energy and relativity and environmental ecosystems all the time. But socially, behaviorally, we very often still live in Model 2.
We treat the world around us like a machine. And we treat other people like isolated, replaceable pogs.
We just haven't fully integrated that organic, interconnected understanding into our daily lives yet. We're essentially living in a Model 2 culture while holding Model 3 science.
But looking all the way back at Plato, you realize he was really the first person to try and build a system where the cosmos was rationally ordered, where it wasn't just terrifying chaos.
He was the pioneer.
But, and here's that twist we promised at the start, Plato was not satisfied with his own masterpiece.
No, he wasn't. And this is genuinely what I love most about him as a thinker.
It is incredible. Holmes takes us to a dialogue called the Parmenides. This is late stage Plato. And he effectively puts his main character, Socrates, in the intellectual boxing ring with a guy named Zeno. And she just lets Zeno pummel Socrates with pure logic.
Zeno is historically famous for his paradoxes. And the core argument he brings up here is about a concept called the many.
Let's hear it.
Zeno argues that if multiple distinct things exist, they have to be like each other because they are all existing things. But they also have to be unlike each other because they are separate, distinct items. Mm-hmm. He says this is a direct contradiction, so logically, the many simply cannot exist.
It is a classic philosophical logic trap. Aristotle later solves it by saying things can be like and unlike at different times or in different respects.
Yeah.
But Plato uses this exact trap to turn the gun on his own theory of forms. And this leads directly to what I like to call the problem of mud.
The extent of forms problem.
Yeah.
It is a massive headache for the theory.
It really is. And it is such a great mental image. So Socrates is sitting there and he is very confident about the form of justice and the form of beauty. Those are noble concepts. They belong in a pristine marble temple. But then he's asked, is there a form of mud? Is there a form of hair? Is there a form of dirt? Or, you know, excretion.
And Holmes notes how deeply, visibly uncomfortable this was for an aristocratic Greek philosopher to even consider.
Oh, they hated it.
They wanted philosophy to exclusively be about the good, the true, and the beautiful. But the underlying logic of the theory is totally ruthless. If absolutely everything in the physical world is a copy of a form, then there mathematically must be an eternal, perfect archetype of mud.
Ideal mud. The perfect scum. It sounds like a joke, but it exposes a massive crack in the entire system. If the world of forms is supposed to be this divine, perfect reality, why on earth is it full of blueprints for garbage?
And that discomfort leads directly to the much darker, much more serious version of that exact same question, the problem of evil.
Yeah.
Because if there is a form for literally everything, is there an eternal form of adultery? Is there a form of murder?
Because if there is, then a murder isn't just a terrible mistake or a glitch in human behavior. It is actually a successful participation in an eternal fundamental reality. And that is just deeply disturbing.
Extremely disturbing. If there is a distinct form of evil, then evil is just as real, just as eternal, and just as foundational as good. Holmes explains that the later Platonists, and eventually the Christian theologians, really had to scramble to fix this bug in the code.
And they came up with two main solutions, right?
Yes. The first one is dualism. Mm-hmm. This is basically just throwing your hands up and accepting that there are two equally ordered realms. One is good, one is bad, and they're just going to fight it out forever.
Like a perpetual cosmic war.
Exactly. Yeah. Star Wars logic. But the second solution, which became the absolute standard for Western Christian theology, is a concept called privation.
Unpack privation for us, because this is a really elegant idea.
The core idea of privation is that evil is not an actual thing in itself. It is a lack of a thing.
Okay.
Think of a hole in a wool sock. You do not create hole. You do not go to the store, buy a handful of hole material, and stitch it into the fabric. The hole is simply the place where the wool isn't.
So the hole is real. I mean, my toe is definitely cold, but the hole itself is not a substance.
Exactly. So under this view, a bad action is not a person participating in some dark form of badness. It is actually a person failing to adequately participate in the form of goodness. It is a deprivation, a depravity.
That is just such a clever philosophical workaround. So if we apply that, I am not ugly because I am actively participating in the eternal form of ugly. I am just doing a really terrible job of participating in the form of beauty.
That is the polite way to put it. Yes, you are just heavily beauty deficient.
I will gladly take that. It completely saves the theory from having to enshrine evil as a permanent, eternal truth. But then Holmes hits us with one final logic puzzle from Plato himself that really seems to stump them. The third man argument.
The third man argument. This is the one that arguably just breaks the mechanics of the whole Platonic system because mm-hmm. It creates an infinite regress.
Walk us through this one carefully because honestly, it twisted my brain up a little bit when I was reading the note.
Okay, let's take it step by step. Imagine you have an individual man, let's call him Socrates, and floating up in the eternal realm, you have the form of humanness. Plato's rule says that Socrates is human strictly because he resembles that form. They share a likeness. Are you with me?
Right. It is like a cookie resembles the cookie cutter that stamped it out.
Sure, that works. Yeah. But here is the fatal logical trap. How do you objectively know that they resemble each other?
Hmm.
To see the resemblance between the physical Socrates and the eternal form, you have to step back and look at them both together. You need a higher standard of comparison that covers both of them. You need a third thing, a third man, to establish that link.
Okay, I follow. So now I have three discrete things. I have Socrates, I have the original form, and now I have this new link that connects them.
Right, but now you have a brand new group of three things. To rationally say that those three things are linked, you naturally need a fourth overarching principle to cover them.
Oh, no.
And to link the four, you need a fifth, then a sixth.
It is the chicken that never actually crosses the road. You can never stop adding links.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It mathematically means you can never fully logically explain the connection between the changing physical world and the perfect world of forms. There's always a gap that requires another link.
That seems pretty devastating to the whole theory.
It is a totally devastating logical critique.
Yeah.
And the fact that Plato wrote this argument himself, actively deploying it against his own life's work, really shows his incredible integrity as a thinker.
Yeah.
He knew his system had holes. He fully knew he couldn't completely explain how the perfect and the imperfect actually touch one another, but he still firmly believed it was the best explanation available to humanity.
So bringing this all together, after all of that, after the mud problem, the privation workaround, the infinite regress of the third man, why are we still talking about this? Why didn't Dr. Holmes just throw this whole thing in the historical trash bin as old, wrong ideas?
Because even if the strict mechanics are flawed, the core foundational insight is still basically the only real alternative to total chaos. Plato gave us the enduring idea that the universe is a cosmos, a rationally ordered place, not a random accident. He suggested that profound values like justice and truth and beauty aren't just chemical reactions firing in our physical brains. They aren't just temporary social constructs. He dared to say they are objectively real.
That they exist outside of us. That they actually matter.
Right. It is the fundamental difference between saying, I happen to like this song, and saying, this song is beautiful with a capital B.
That specific distinction is exactly where Holmes leaves us at the end of his lecture. And I think it is the perfect final thought for us to chew on today. He briefly mentions the historical debate about nominalism in relation to music.
This is a question I really think everyone should ask themselves the very next time they put on their headphones.
Let's lay it out.
Nominalism is the philosophical view that there are no universal forms. None at all. So under that view, a piece of music is literally just a series of isolated physical sounds.
Just air vibrating.
Exactly. It is just air vibrating against your physical eardrum. It is biology and physics interacting. Nothing more, nothing deeper.
That is the ultimate mechanistic model, just matter in motion.
Right. But the opposing view, the Platonic view, is that a great piece of music works precisely because it taps into universal aesthetic structures, structures that are inherent in the very fabric of the universe itself.
Wow.
So that when you hear a complex chord resolve perfectly and it gives you literal physical goosebumps, you are actually hearing a mathematical truth that is every bit as real and eternal as gravity.
That is deeply something to mull over. I mean, when you hear a piece of music that moves you to tears, or you see a brilliant sunset that just stops you in your tracks, are you really just seeing a random biological accident? Or are you just, for a fleeting second, participating in something eternal?
Are you just staring at the shadow? Or are you actually catching a brief glimpse of the form itself?
That is the question. And on that note, we will leave you to wonder about the reality of your own shadows. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the foundational mind of Plato.
Keep thinking out there.